Meeting to order. Today is March 21st, and the days just keep traveling on. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2897.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2897 requires a person to sign an acknowledgement and an agreement regarding driving while under the influence of intoxicants as part of the application process for a driver's license or permit. We have a no revenue impact, and we're still waiting to hear from fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Ann Pratt and Bruce Pratt.
And good afternoon, Chair Byron, members of the committee. I'm Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United. I'm also a member of MED and Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. And I'm also a victim of a secondary victim of a DUI homicide. My son was killed in 1998 by an intoxicated driver. We are here today to ask you to pass House Bill 2897. We believe that we are not doing enough here in Oregon. We are asking that each licensed driver in the state of Oregon sign an acknowledgement and agreement stating that I acknowledge that driving while under the influence of intoxicants can seriously injure or result in death. I agree not to drive under the influence of intoxicants. We are asking for a separate signature line, lettering to be in bold, copies to be kept on file by DMV, to be placed on new and renewed driver's license applications, which includes permits. This is a simple statement, but it would serve as a very bold and binding reminder that each and every one of us is responsible. Driving in Oregon is a privilege and not a right. Alcohol plays a very large part in the American culture. I believe sometimes we are looking the other way when it comes to the intoxicated driver, and sometimes we are almost complacent. I don't believe there is a person in this room that could not tell me a story about someone who was killed by a drunk driver, or even perhaps that they know someone who was a drunk driver. The facts are 3 out of 10 of us will actually encounter an intoxicated driver in our lifetime. We need to be doing a better job. We need to stop looking the other way. This is not only a criminal problem, it is a problem rooted deeply within our society and tolerated, is tolerated within our society. Excuses that I've heard since my son was killed have been many. It couldn't happen to me. It was just an accident. He or she wasn't in their right mind. Maybe he or she shouldn't have been there. It must have been his time to go. And sometimes the driver who kills even says, I didn't know. And my personal favorite is, I thought I could make it home. That's what the drunk driver said who killed my son. This is about prevention. This agreement and acknowledgement would serve as a warning, a deterrent, an educational tool, and a reminder. And if it saved just one life, it would be worth it. It's a warning. It's much like the warning that you see on the bottle of alcohol or the cigarette package. And on the cigarette package, it turned out to be true. Smoking cigarettes really does kill. And the consumption of alcohol by pregnant women really does cause fetal alcohol syndrome. Drinking and driving really does kill, too. We have heard over and over. We hear of and see alcohol advertisement over and over, and it has a huge impact on our young drivers. We need to have countermeasures, and alcohol is the number one problem with our youth. In our lifetime, we agree to sign for many things, and for lots of different reasons. Prescriptions, petitions, we sign for packages, We agree to license agreements for lots of things, even when we download a new program on our computer. Pledges are not new either. There's Pledge America that was popular in the 80s. My sons came home from school with a pledge form for me to sign as a parent, for us to sign as parents, and for them to sign. It was co-sponsored between MAD and I believe it was Rotary Club of Portland. Progressive Insurance has had a pledge. California, even the Centra Council had a type of a pledge. This is an opportunity to make a difference, particularly with the youthful driver. The 15-year-old would sign the agreement, acknowledgement and agreement when he applied for a permit, then again when he turned 16 and received his driver's license, then again at 24. And it's really important because these are the deadly years for males. Actually, it's up to 34 years. It's really important to get that message out to them. Studies show also in a Gallup poll of the general driving age public, 97% see drinking and driving as a threat to their personal safety. I believe asking drivers to sign this very direct personal reminder is not too much to ask when taking on the responsibility of getting behind the wheel of 3,000 pounds of steel. It only takes one moment in time, an event, an experience, something we see, something we hear, an acknowledgement, an agreement to change history. Life, a life taken or a life saved. Please pass this bill and make it a positive change in Oregon history. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Pratt from Crime Victims United. You made House Bill 2897 is a bill that you may remember as House Bill 2901 from the 2003 session, which passed the House unanimously at 57-0. I would never want to minimize what happened on that fateful day in 2001, 9/11 to be exact. Over 3,000 people lost their lives in that tragedy, and there was outrage. Yet over 17,000 people die every year at the hands of intoxicated drivers. If my calculations are correct, that means 93,500 of us have been killed since 9/11. Due to intoxicated driving. This is the enemy within. Where is the outrage? In Oregon, meanwhile, 201 people were killed and over 2,000 have been seriously injured in 2005. We are also allowing our state's children to be killed. Between 2000 and 2004, of the 27 children between ages birth to 14 killed in alcohol-related crashes, 22, or 81%, were passengers in a vehicle driven by someone who had been drinking. Where is the outrage? California may have become aware of this bill when it was originally proposed in 2003. They have introduced a similar law, and I refer to you in our attachment to our written testimony to the California Assembly Bill 808, and I will quote from toward the bottom of the page. The people of the state of California do enact as follows. Section 1, Section 13385 is added to the vehicle code to read, all application forms for driver's licenses or driver's license renewal notices shall include a requirement that the application sign the following declaration as a condition of licensure. I am hereby advised that being under the influence of the alcohol or drugs or both impairs the ability to safely operate a motor vehicle. Therefore, it is extremely dangerous to human life to drive while under the influence of alcohol or drugs or both. If I drive while under the influence of alcohol or drugs or both, and as a result, a person is killed, I can be charged with murder. Let us in Oregon be the first in the country to require drivers to sign this statement. Now, in California right now, anyone under 21 is required to sign a statement acknowledging that they have been notified by DMV about laws on drinking and driving. The National Transportation Safety Administration states that alcohol-related crashes cost nearly $1 billion a year in Oregon. If we can save even one death caused by intoxicated driving, which costs society $3.6 million each, or one serious injury, which has been found to cost $108,000, this is worth the effort. This is a prevention bill. It can and will save lives. I appreciate your listening to us and hope you vote yes on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Excuse me, Chair Beyer, I forgot something. May I?
Yes.
This is a form that I picked up from DMV a couple days ago, and here there's a signature line, and this is the form. It's called their camera card, I believe, that we're asking to have the line inserted and the verbiage. And it would also involve this form, which is the driver's license application, and also combination permit. And a couple other ID card, motorcycle endorsement. So those are the forms that we believe would be involved in this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I'm seeing no questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don Phillips.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Don Phillips, Chief of Staff for State Representative Jerry Crummell. And by way of background, this bill, as Bruce mentioned, was passed unanimously by the House in 2003, and it was Representative Randy Miller's bill at the time, House Bill 2901. And we also worked with Representative Crummell and Representative Gordon Anderson on the Judiciary Committee very heavily to get this bill through, and that's why I believe it was such a success, because we had such a good partnership with our friends on the Judiciary Committee, the Transportation Committee. You'll hear from Mothers Against Drunk Driving and advocates like Ann and Bruce. And so today, Representative Crummell wanted me to come and just kind of give you a little bit of that historical perspective and then see if you had any questions, because sometimes the institutional knowledge helps to kind of get over some of the questions that you may have. A lot of us are probably asking, why do we need this statement? We all know it's wrong to drink too much and get behind the wheel. Apparently not, or we wouldn't have so many DUI arrests and traffic crashes every year. It's like Ann said, police hear excuses all the time. Well, I just had a couple of beers. This way, we will hold people accountable because they have to see it and sign it. It's been estimated that every convicted drunk driver has probably driven drunk up to 80 times before they were ever arrested. Some folks just don't get it. Maybe this one preventive step will help them get it. Maybe they'll think twice before they get behind the wheel again. As Ann and Bruce and others will tell you, this is about personal responsibility. It's about accountability. And in addition, I think, and Representative Crummell and I have talked about this, this new statement will make a statement for the legislature about how serious we are about cracking down on drinking and driving. Working for the co-chair of Ways and Means, Representative Miller gave me quite a bit of insight into the budget world. So if you have any questions about how the fiscal or budget impact was came together on this legislation before, or any of that kind of process, I'm happy to stick around and answer any questions, and we just ask your support for this very important legislation.
Thank you. Representative Tillman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don, I don't have a keen memory of what happened a couple of years ago. So it passed the House unanimously, and it went to the Senate.
We had a hearing, Chair Beyer and Representative Tillman. We had a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee. We had quite a bit of support there, but we just couldn't move the chair to get the bill out of committee.
Thank you. And follow-up, please. So remind us what the fiscal impact would be.
You'll have to look at and talk to your folks down at LFO, because it has been three sessions since they looked at this before. If you'll look at the material I believe that staff provided you from the old fiscal, it talked about, and I'll just quote you from it, given that the DMV maintains 64 field offices, the Legislative Fiscal Office believes this level of additional staff support could be absorbed within existing resources.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Great.
Seeing none.
Thank you.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Mary Stewart.
Chair Beyer, members of the House Transportation Committee, I thank you for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. I'm Mary Stewart, the new Affiliate Executive Director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I'm based out of the Portland Affiliate Office, which serves the 25 northern counties in Oregon. And I'm testifying today in support of House Bill 2897. Alcohol-impaired driving is really the most often committed violent crime. Nearly 17,000 people killed annually, and 500,000 others injured in alcohol-related traffic crashes each year. Now, in Oregon, you can use 177 killed a year. You can use alcohol-related, which is 201 killed a year. And we count 6,000 injured a year in Oregon from drunk driving. I think regardless of which way you count it, the cost is way too high. That's three people killed a week and 115 people injured per week. NAD supports efforts to educate the public about the dangers of impaired driving, including House Bill 2897, which informs and reminds Oregonians about the risks and the responsibilities when first receiving their driver's license, and then reminds them again as they renew their license. House Bill 2897 provides an element of deterrence, and that invokes accountability and acknowledgement of the seriousness of driving while intoxicated. The concept of general deterrence refers to preventing crimes before they occur. Preventing crimes before they occur. And it's a theory that often is difficult to explain. It's difficult to measure on a day-to-day basis. But long-term research shows us that over time, incorporating these methods of deterrence is the best strategy to employ if you're trying to reduce this staggering number of fatal alcohol-related crashes. And this is a concept, by the way, extracted from our own national research and published in our law enforcement journal in 2006. I do hope you'll join us in our quest to completely eliminate drunk driving. And I think by passing this bill, you'll take a big step in helping make that happen. I thank you so much for the opportunity to testify, and I certainly ask for any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? What a quiet group today. It's been a long day, I guess. thank you.
Most welcome.
Appreciate you coming. That is all I have signed up. And I don't know if there's anybody else out there that would like to testify on this.
Madam Chair. Are we not going to hear from the department, the DMV, at some point?
Thank you, Representative Butler. I was just thinking about inviting them up because I did have a question. They were not going to testify unless people had specific questions that they needed answered. So,
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, here to answer your questions.
Thank you, Representative Butler. You have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. Jack, I am anxious about just wanting to know, looking at the fiscal report from the department previously, I understand that this would be just one extra line on the application itself, one extra line on the actual, I think Ms. Pratt called it the camera card. Is that... unless you've got a 15 or 20 year supply of the forms, that's probably a form that you get reprinted every year. Is there any fiscal cost to this?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, that's true. This would add a signature line. It would add a bullet and an additional signature line to the form. What they've calculated would be the equivalent of a position for DMV, and that's based on the number of, it's just an estimate based on the number of additional seconds of contact with customers across over a million transactions, and that generates about 75% of a position. So that's essentially what the impact would be.
Follow up, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Presently, the existing questions that people have as they sign their name, do I sign here, the time that it takes to say sign here and here would be an additional few seconds and times the million plus transactions you're estimating. But this extra position, would they work 15 minutes in Vail and 15 minutes in Ontario and then 15 minutes? Tell me about that extra position.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, that is the question that I ask. How do you do that when you've got one position and it's generated by an activity that is carried out in 64 different offices? And what our duty is to put together a fiscal that reflects the number of transactions and what that impact would be on our workforce. The actual deployment of that workforce is really up to DMV management, and it wouldn't be a situation where you'd have a roving clerk going from one office to the other, but management would have to take a look at how the positions are deployed, which offices maybe have more traffic and which are having a greater need for additional staffing. So that's about the best we can do in this kind of an estimate.
Thank you. Additional follow-up. Jack, I understand that the department has a number of not necessarily policy option packages, certainly a policy option package for improved computer access, enhanced computer service time, and so forth. It's also my understanding that the computer packages that we provided through the JLCIMT over the last 4 years for the department has increased the capacity for handling transactions, the gigabytes and so forth, by double. Have you had to reduce any employees as a result of the fact that you've actually been able to half the time that it takes to wait for computer screens?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I'd have to inquire about that. I'm not familiar with that, and I'm not aware of a staff reduction, and I'd have to ask them, you know, about that specific period of time and whether that was balanced with increase customer contact. I really don't have that answer for you right now. I'll certainly find out.
Thank you. Very excellent response, Madam Chair. And I guess my immediate first blush reaction would be that if previously where a transaction took 3 to 5 seconds to have to wait for the computer screen to come back and flash the information back. Now that's instantaneous, or in half the time. If you're talking about saying sign here and sign there, I think that's something that probably that extra person's worth of time has certainly gone away. So it looks like to me that there's an excellent trade-off. That plus the fact that over the past 4 years, the actual waiting time for the computers has not just halved, it's probably come down to about a tenth of what it was. Thus, we probably should be enjoying a huge reduction in volume, and that this probably is one of the reasons why in 2003 the JLCIMT and the Ways and Means co-chair could extract from the department that really there isn't additional time that would be needed or additional staff that would be needed because of the efficiencies, because of the faster computer service time and response time at the speed of light. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Any other questions? My question's got asked, and thank you very much.
Sure.
Well, I had I was approached by Representative Barker, who's the chief sponsor on this bill, to say that there was a possibility of an amendment out there, so and not to move it today. So I am going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and we will wait on this bill for further action. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on House Bill 2899. And Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House Bill 2899 directs the Department of Transportation to immediately inform law enforcement if an applicant for a driver's license, driver permit, or identification card submits a false application, that is, with false documentation. You have also received a Dash 1 amendment. That amendment requires the department to retain any document believed to be fraudulent and to provide that document to law enforcement. It provides Department of Transportation employees immunity from civil liability for any action taken under the measure. And it changes the wording a bit on the bill. Let me get the right line here for you. If you look on the bill, section 2, page 1, line 6, it would change the wording. Instead of the department has a reason to believe, it would read whenever the department believes that an applicant for a driver's license has indeed provided some false information. That's the Dash 1 amendment, and we have no revenue impact, and still, again, on this one, waiting for the fiscal impact. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Would Jack Evans like to come back up?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation, here to speak to House Bill 2899, which deals with false application reporting. This bill would require Department of Transportation to notify law enforcement immediately whenever they have reason to believe that an applicant for a driver's license, a permit, or an ID card submits a false application. At this time, as a matter of policy, DMV does call the police if they suspect identity theft. If somebody's applying in someone else's name and that they have that suspicion, they will immediately contact the police. They have not traditionally notified the police in situations where an individual is still using their own name. Perhaps they need three documents. Two of them are legitimate, and the third is appears to be a false document. The policy has been to not call the police, to send the person away and let them know that they're not going to get a driver's license or a permit until they come back with real documents. Since last summer, a pilot has been underway in six DMV offices, in which The police are contacted, and in every situation, a person presents what appears to be a false document. And the response from law enforcement has been excellent. In virtually every single case, law enforcement has responded. It's high on their list of priorities. And we don't really know what the ultimate conclusion of the cases were. And we know that in some cases there were citations and fines. But police responded. The police response was so good that DMV has now made a policy decision to expand that to all offices effective May 1 of this year. So we're going to proceed with notifying law enforcement every time we get a situation that someone presents a false document. And I had not had an opportunity to look at the Dash 1 amendments. If you'd like, I could make a comment about them. The first one deals with has reason to believe is changes to believes. And I understand from the bill's proponents that makes it easier as far as evidence-wise for DMV to make a judgment about a particular document. The second part of it that deals with the department shall retain any document the department reasonably believes to be fraudulent and provide the document to the appropriate law enforcement agency. That, I believe, is the subject of a current Senate bill. And, of course, we're required to be neutral on these things, but I have heard, was informed by DMV management that that could also be a useful tool in DMV with dealing with individuals that present themselves, present false documents to DMV. So with that, I'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Oh, did you? Okay. Jack, from what you're saying, it sounds like you're already doing this as of May. Correct.
Chair by Representative Tomei, that's correct. As of May, we will do what is, as a matter of policy, what's in the bill as originally written. However, the amendment which deals with the retention of documents is something that we don't do now. We would need statutory authority to do that.
I see. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Jack, you'd indicated that this was being very successfully implemented in 6 DMV offices with excellent police response. Can you give us some flavor? I think these, you told me previously that these were in the metropolitan area here along the I-5 corridor. Can you give us some idea of, number one, the number of incidents, number two, the types of documents that you're presently calling into question?
Chair by Representative Butler, yes, that there were 6 offices that included McMinnville, Woodburn, Eugene, Springfield, Hillsboro, and Tannisbourne, and they were involved in the pilot. The types of documents, there are ones that appear on the primary and secondary list, which is a list that DMV uses to a list of documents required, and these include things like birth certificate, passport, social security card, those types of things. In the results in the Eugene and Springfield offices, there were a total of 25 calls to law enforcement, and there was a response to all 25 of those calls. That was one of the offices where they actually looked at both U.S. and foreign documents. The other offices didn't include foreign documents because they're a lot trickier, frankly. Northwest region is Woodburn and McMinnville. There were 10 calls to law enforcement, and all 10 responded to them. And in the Sunset region, there were a total of 8 calls to law enforcement, and the law enforcement was able to respond to 7 of those. So it was almost 100% response rate for that period of time.
Madam Chair, follow-up, if I may. I think it would be appropriate for Jack to supply the members, all of the members of the committee, the document list that they have. I would like to see that. And then, second of all, a question for Jack, if I may. Jack, what formal training do you give your staff to try and detect what might be a fraudulent document. Are they familiar with what would be an Israeli passport versus a Portugal passport versus a third world country from some other place?
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, the staff, there's a training program that the AAMVA, the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, has packaged, and DMV sends their trainers to that and then come back and train staff. And it's pretty extensive, dealing primarily with U.S. documents and various things to look for in determining, in general, document authenticity, and then in specific some things with U.S. documents. There's also a program that is a licensed program that DMV belongs to or has the franchise for, and that is called DocuTector. And that has pictures and information on documents that come before DMV and gives them a lot of information about those documents and what to look for and what are some key factors of things that are often altered. In addition, DMV staff has black lights at their posts and other things that they look for. And I had the opportunity to spend a couple hours at a very busy DMV office in Northeast Portland and stood behind as they were looking at all manner of documents. And the fellow was explaining to me what they look for on documents, what's embedded in the documents that they can determine, and how they can find out what the bogus documents are, determine which ones those are. They also work with some foreign governments such as Mexico with things that are common like the consulate card and know what to look for that. But there are a lot of documents out there, and most of them would be, I don't think they appear on the primary list. There are some on the secondary list, foreign government issued documents without English translation. You would need to have other supporting documents with them. But when I was at the office, there was a fellow that came from Ethiopia, and there was another fellow, I think, from Nigeria. So, I mean, this was an amazingly dispersed group of folks from different countries. So I'm not sure that anyone can be up to speed on every one of those types of documents. And, of course, if Real ID passes, that'll be something that's tightened up even further. So the training is pretty good, and the staff that I've seen in operation are really excellent. The other thing they do, I might add, is when they look at a piece of documentation and verify it, they'll go over and ask another person at the counter to also verify that what they're looking at is accurate as well.
Just one observation and then a question. I think the fellow that was here from Nigeria was to deliver a check to me for $25 billion. I never did see him. I got a sneaking suspicion you've screened him out. But give me an example, Jack, of what you saw that might have been information that was screened out. Are we talking about perhaps a utility bill that's been taped over or something of that nature? What?
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, when I was there, I didn't see anybody screened out. All the documentation appeared to be accurate and passed the test. But there are things that people can come up with that, you know, for example, a Social Security card or something that's been obviously altered, a driver's license from another state that's been tampered with, either the age or the name on it. Those are the kinds of things I think they're looking for. Or documents that are that don't contain the embedded security features, and I think that's how they catch a lot of folks. People will go out and they may have two documents that are accurate, but they don't have that third document, so they buy it from somebody that embeds their name in it, but it may not have the security features, and they can pick that up either with a black light or some other techniques.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm really upset about the fact that I didn't get my check. Probably screened him out. Oh, you got it. I think, Madam Chair, the balance, the budget has been balanced.
We just found
the rest of the budget balance.
Okay, we have Bob Stye.
Yes.
Okay, I'll bring you all up. Dan Fennell, Larry Kanzler, and Kip Branch. If you want to pull up another chair and you can all come up. You can decide who wants to go first. Just make sure you identify yourself.
I'm just a lieutenant, so I'm going to yield to the chief.
Okay.
Well, I think we're going to yield to the prosecutor. Prosecutor will lead us.
Chair Byron, members of the committee, my name is Dan Tennell. I'm the chair of the Legislative Committee for the Regional Economic Crime Investigation Center, which we are all, or our agencies here, members of. As Chief Kanzler alluded to, I'm a former prosecutor for Washington County, which I did for 6 years before entering private practice. And since private practice, I've worked in the insurance defense world and also concentrating a lot of my work on insurance fraud issues. In some respects, I feel very glad to be here today because the genesis for this bill is something that has been important to me for several years, and I need to give you a little history, but I'll try to be brief. When I was a prosecutor in Washington County, I was responsible, along with an attorney from the Oregon Attorney General's office, for a large-scale driver's license fraud ring that was operating in the Hillsborough and Beaverton areas. That scheme resulted in what we believed at the time to be possibly tens of thousands of driver's license being issued to out-of-state residents. Part of the reason that scheme was ongoing for the time that it was and resulted in the number of driver's licenses that it did was because of some of the documentation that was allowed at that time to be used to prove identity and residency for the state of Oregon. It also, in the course of that investigation, we learned that at that time, and what I believe still exists, was a policy within the Department of Motor Vehicles, which I believe you've heard here today, that prohibits their employees from calling the police in certain circumstances when crimes are being committed in a state building. And I want to use an example because I think unless you're actively involved in the law enforcement community, it can get lost. We need to distinguish between identity theft and a forgery. If I went into a DMV and presented a piece of documentation where I tried to pass myself off as Larry Kanzler, who's the chief of the Milwaukee Police Department, that under Oregon law would be an identity theft, and we believe, at that time I still believe, the DMV would be required by policy to call law enforcement to investigate that crime. However, if I came in with a forged birth certificate from another country or from Oregon, or a forged Social Security card, a forged rental application that said I was Dan Tennell, but those documents were forged, there is an affirmative policy at the time that we learned of, and at least existed up until September of last year, that would prohibit employees from the Department of Motor Vehicles from calling law enforcement in those circumstances. We believe that DMV wants this bill, and in fact, at a RESIC Foundation board meeting in September of 2006, at which I was present, we had two members of DMV staff there to talk about a number of fraud-related issues that involve DMV. In addition to the Real ID Act, I asked them, based on the information I learned as a prosecutor, if the policy that I learned about while I was a prosecutor was still in existence, and it was affirmed that it was in existence. The reaction to this piece of legislation from members of the Department of Motor Vehicles was positive. They said they would support it, but it was not something that they could propose. We on the RESIC Foundation Board and the RESIC Legislative Committee will hope that you will give DMV the tool to continue to stop fraud-related crimes in this state that are impacting so many. There has been a lot of material and several bills as a package that will help fight identity theft and fraud-related crimes and help stop Oregon citizens from being victimized by these crimes. I was, along with the other members of the legislative committee, the ones that proposed the friendly amendments in 2899-1. I believe that it is important to have the direction to DMV to turn these documents over to law enforcement so these crimes can be investigated properly and prosecuted appropriately, and to also give the Department of Motor Vehicles and their employees immunity from any civil suits by turning these over to law enforcement. I'd be happy to answer any questions either now or at the end of our group presentation, and I want to thank you for allowing me to speak before you today.
Thank you.
Should we wait for all four of them?
Yeah, why don't we go ahead?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Larry Kanzler. I'm the Chief of Police of the City of Milwaukee and designated representative for the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police to a collaborative identity theft committee recommended by the governor that also includes the Department of Motor Vehicles, the Oregon Sheriff's Association, the Oregon District Attorney's Association, and private industry banking and credit union associations. With the task force of the responsibility of the task force of making recommendations to reduce identity theft in Oregon. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2899 with amendments, which directs the confiscation of documents by DMV when DMV personnel believe the documents are fraudulent and are of the basis of providing identity for the issuance of DMV-issued driver's licenses and DMV-issued identity cards. Identity theft is the fastest growing crime in Oregon and in the nation. One of the primary methods criminals use to create a false identity is by applying for a driver's license or identity card using false or forged documents. House Bill 2899 with amendments provides the Department of Transportation and its employees with immunity from civil liability for taking actions to enforce the seizure of documents believed to be fraudulent. The seizure of suspected fraudulent documents will be a significant step toward reducing identity theft in Oregon. Criminals who prey on vulnerable credentialing agencies use the fraudulently obtained identification to obtain credit cards, open bank checking accounts, apply for loans, and in general, pillage individuals and businesses in our state. Currently, DMV employees have no authority to seize documents they believe are false and are required to return suspected false documents to the presenter. House Bill 2899 with amendments provides that DMV employees shall seize documents believed to be false and turn the suspected false documents over to the nearest law enforcement agency for investigation and prosecution. If, after the investigation, the documents are found to be valid, they'll be returned to the presenter. The passage of House Bill 2899 with amendments will close a significant door that criminals use to access DMV licenses and identity cards, while at the same time providing immunity to Department of Transportation employees who do the right thing by seizing false documents they believe are presented fraudulently. In conclusion, we request your support and passage of House Bill 2899 with amendments to allow the Department of Transportation, in partnership with law enforcement, to protect the identity of our citizens from those intent on destroying people's lives and fleecing the lending institutions of our state. I urge your favorable consideration and passage of House Bill 2899 with amendments. Thank you for your time and consideration, and subject to your questions, I'm available to you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Bob Stye. My address is 100 High Street, Northeast, Salem. I work as a lieutenant with the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2899, a tool to help both DMV and law enforcement kind of work on a common goal. What I briefly would like to share with you is how we are working together with DMV and utilizing one of the tools that we currently have. And first of all, I think both law enforcement and DMV realize that the common goal for all of us is to try to prevent and deter the either the misuse or the fraudulent use of our Oregon licenses, our driver's license, and our ID cards that are issued to us by DMV. In part, to help prevent and deter this illegal activity, several things need to occur, to include, in part, enhancing our working relationship between law enforcement and DMV, as well as using the existing tools and hopefully getting additional tools to help us deal with this. But for example, DMV currently has a tool that they can use, which is basically they have the administrative authority to suspend a person who uses an Oregon or uses an Oregon DL or license or permit for fraudulent activity. However, DMV needs to have the information communicated to them by law enforcement as to this occurring. Some time ago, we started to work more effectively together by providing DMV with this information that they needed so they could utilize their existing tools. Several law enforcement jurisdictions, using by just completing a real simple form, were able to provide information that DMV needed so they can assess whether or not they could use the current existing tools to suspend a person's privilege from obtaining a license. This form was sent out to various law enforcement jurisdictions. It's a form that when a police officer seizes a driver's license or a switch tag or a stolen license plate where they attach this form to that item, and the law enforcement agency sends that in to DMV explaining why that document or license was seized. And then that provides DMV with that information so that they can assess whether or not, once again, they can utilize their current existing tools. That's just an example of how we are working together with DMV on existing tools to help prevent fraudulent activity of our Oregon driver's license and licenses. And I just want to thank you for your time, and we're happy to respond to any questions later on.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Detective Kip Branch. I'm with the Washington County Sheriff's Office. I am currently assigned to the Fraud Night AA Theft Enforcement Team. I've been in the Investigations Division for probably about 10 years now. And I got to tell you, I enjoy fraud work immensely, but it's an ongoing battle that apparently that's why the commander called me last night and said, hey, how'd you like to testify before the committee? It took me no more than about 10 seconds to find the file that was sitting on my desk that was a shining example of why it is that we're asking for these controls to be put in place. I've got some photos, and I'd be happy to share some of this information for you to look at before I leave. This is Mr. Contreras, Juan Contreras. The information on here shows that he lives in Redmond. Basically, what we have is an application for a driver's license here in Oregon. On the application, you'll see on page 2, it talks about what was used at the time and what was viewed by the individual at DMV, the employee, to allow him to get that driver's license. The box that was checked there is a driver's license or ID card. Nothing else at that time appears to have been checked. So they went ahead and give Mr. Contreras a driver's license with that name and information. What we come to find out a little bit later is Mr. Contreras, if that was his real name, also went and applied for a driver's license using another name of Francisco, Humberto Guzman Cazares. On page 2 of this document, you'll see that they also check the driver's license or other ID card, and they have a notation there of DPL on the second page with nothing else being checked. It's very apparent as you look at the images that it is most definitely the same individual. He's wearing the same goatee. He doesn't really change his appearance very much. Last but not least, you have Francisco Rodolfo Uribe. Same gentleman, same appearance, coming in to get another driver's license, this time in Tannisbourne. And from what I can see on these documents, it shows they provide a birth certificate, a social security card, and a piece of mail. I'm certainly by no means an expert in foreign documents, but I think it's safe to say that at some point in this process, Mr. Contreras or Mr. Guzman or Mr. Uribe provided some documents that were forged or false. With training that really doesn't have to be very specialized, individuals can quickly pick up on the subtleties of those counterfeit documents. And hopefully give us an opportunity to investigate this individual or individuals like him before he picks up additional licenses from the Department of Motor Vehicles. I can tell you that this particular individual was investigated by Bend Police Department, and I'm not sure where the criminal case stands at this point, but he had defrauded a furniture company in Bend out of several thousand dollars of furniture. At this point, I know a great deal more about Mr. Uribe. I can't explain to you exactly why he would need three different driver's licenses with three different names other than to avoid detection. You know, this is one small case of what we see off and on throughout the year. We have a lot of counterfeiting cases that that don't even involve DMV directly, but these cases still continue. The original supervisor for our unit was Sean Fisher. He's currently a lieutenant in our division and overseeing our unit again. He had a case just prior to our unit being started where some of the individuals he investigated had obtained a dozen or more different driver's licenses and different names at that time. That particular case was finished and at some point sent up to the district attorney's office. I don't know what the resolution was there. All I'm asking for as an investigator is a little beef behind the policy that may already be putting in place there at Department of Motor Vehicles. Allow the language to tell them, please, if you think it is, hold on to it, give the police call, let the experts make that determination. Let's get it stopped before it gets to the point where they're using that false information that we've helped them get, and they go out and do this account fraud and other theft out in the real world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find it very interesting that the four of you, three of you are carrying hog legs, and you defer to the guy that isn't carrying the weapon. So,
we know where the power is.
Oh, I had a question first for Bob Stein. Bob, you said that you did seize a driver's license at one time from the person. Did they voluntarily just go ahead and allow the driver's license to be turned over and then seized?
Chair Byer and members of committee. No, usually it's not a voluntary thing. They don't have a choice. They're driving with a suspended license. If they're driving in a vehicle that has a switch plate, we take it. But what we need to do is make sure DMV understands the reason why we're doing it. So, but no, they usually don't voluntarily give that stuff up.
Follow up, if I may,
yes,
Madam Chair. I think I have a misconception of where the activities are taking place. Are these are not? We're talking now about on the road versus at the DMV office. We've got DMV personnel that are examining, and maybe I have a total misunderstanding of what this legislation is to help us to do. Certainly, we don't want identity theft, but I have 100% confidence in the law enforcement and peace officers that are on the front lines. My concern is at the office of the DMV when they are having multiple presentations of identification of Uribe, Juan, Guzman, and those kinds of things. My concern, and I hope I can convey this, is that these are most likely very, very dangerous people. And we have people who, yes, are trained in with docutectors and other kinds of training and so forth, but they are not DPSST-trained people in those offices typically. So I'm concerned for the well-being and the welfare of folks that when they start to look at some of these documents that are being passed across, including what would eventually be determined while they were on that side of the counter, that stuff was phony. How do we protect our employees and what? I'm just concerned when we get some folks involved in saying, Mr. Uribe, this really doesn't pass the smell test. Would you wait here for just a moment while I take all of your information and go to the telephone to call the cops? And I just need the kind of response there. I'm anxious for the hundreds, if not thousands, of state employees that we've got who are putting their safety on the line and maybe jeopardizing their own well-being.
Chair Byron, members of the committee, I'm going to defer to the chief on this one. And if he doesn't get it right, I'll respond back.
Chair Byron, Representative Butler, what we've experienced is when people bring in the fraudulent documents to obtain driver's license and identity cards, that if it's questioned, they usually flee. But in the past, what has happened is DMV has been obligated to give them back these fraudulent documents.
It's so chase them out in the parking lot?
Well, they give them back to them rather than confront them about the issue. But when they are confronted about the issue, they usually flee. We have not had an incident that we have recorded where a DMV employee has been assaulted or even verbally accosted when they've called police. What has happened is the subject usually grabs the documents back and walks out the door and leaves, or is given the documents back and goes out the door and leaves, again, to go to one of the other 64 DMV offices to try this fraud again. And what this does is it provides them, if you go into the Kmart store and you try to pass and utter a bad check, the Kmart cashier takes your check away from you and takes your identity too and seizes it right there at the spot and then calls the police. And usually what we have in those situations is consistent with what we believe is taking place at DMV offices, in that the suspect then runs out the door and tries to escape. They don't want to confront law enforcement. And they don't want to confront anybody there. They're more intent on escaping than they are causing a fight or a provoking a problem. Once law enforcement, and there's also another thing that you mentioned that's critically important in this, is that DMV gets probably four times more fraud document training than any police officer in the state of Oregon. And we are now partnering with DMV to try to collaborate with them on their excellent false document examination training that they do provide, so that we can include that into the DPSST training program when new officers come through. But they deal with it every day. Police officers deal with it periodically and situationally. I've been in law enforcement now for 41 years and had the privilege of being chief of police in three different agencies, large and small, Portland to Toledo, Oregon. So I have seen this identity theft issue grow exponentially over the last 20 years. It's gone from almost a blip now to a huge problem. And we need all the tools we can muster to try to cope with the problems these folks are creating. And being able to seize the documents, get the documents off the street so we're not dealing with the same documents over and over and over again is a huge step in the right direction.
One more follow-up, if I may. I'd like to know what the principle, and particularly maybe in some of the actual cases, what's the principle use of this multiple or extra ID? What's the criminal activity that's involved there? And second of all, once I've had phony documents presented to office number one of the 64 DMV, is there some intercommunication with all of the 63 other offices, or do they have to start from scratch and say, in other words, is the name then put on alert, or is there some way to communicate that?
Currently, the way the situation works, there is no interconnectivity between agencies. Now, the Department of Motor Vehicles under Senate Bill 640, which was adopted 2 years ago, will allow for DMV to go to biometrics, and the biometrics will also work through a central issuing agency. In other words, a central point of issuance. And so when you go to your DMV office in Roseburg, that license is actually issued out of a central agency or central office rather than out of the Roseburg office. Like now, if you go to the Roseburg office and you want to renew your license, they hand it to you right back over the counter. The central issuance will then collect the biometrics data so that they can compare one to many and see that you are who you say you are, or even if you're not who you say you are, at least it's consistent with the same name that's on the driver's license. This is an immigration act, this, or any kind of an immigration bill. This is to approve that if you say you're Larry Kanzler, that in any DMV office you go to renew your license, you're still going to be Larry Kanzler. You're not going to be, Joe Smith. So it connects that, but we're 2 years away from that. We're 2 years away from implementing that because of the infrastructure development has to take place with DMV. And it still doesn't prevent me from coming in with documents that are forged or false and representing myself to be somebody else. If I don't already have a driver's license in Oregon, there will be no way to detect whether I'm getting a false license or not. So even under Senate Bill 640, it won't be able to do that. So it will challenge false documents to make sure that they're accurate, and it will, if the documents are suspect, it will call in law enforcement into the agency to review those documents and scrutinize them so that we're issuing licenses to people who are who they say they are.
And the primary reason for the fraudulent documents?
There's a number of reasons, Representative Butler. Number one, for this particular individual, is kind of twofold. Number one is evading detection by law enforcement while committing whatever crimes he's going to commit. Primarily in his case, it's account fraud. So as he changes his name, short of being booked into a local jail and having his fingerprints run through AFIS, nobody's going to know that he's not Juan Contreras or, you know, Humberto Guzman. Generally that's what you're talking about. The long and short for the majority of the individuals that do this, it's all about account fraud. The more names that you have, the more accounts you can dummy up, and the more debt you can run without being caught.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Counselor, if I went into the DMV in Gladstone to get a new driver's license and I give them my birth certificate and they think it's fraudulent and so they take it, and I would assume they would give it to, does Gladstone have a chief of police? So they give it to the Gladstone Police Department. How soon could I get it back if it were not fraudulent?
Chair Beyer and Representative Tomei, it's been our experience that we can have probably a 2-day turnaround. So we can inquire on that on that identity, and sometimes even faster than that. But if it's a legitimate document with DocuScan, which is the equipment that is located at all the DMV offices, they can make that determination on the spot.
Follow up. So what process would I have to go through to get it back?
You'd be contacted by law enforcement, and they would probably have questions of you. If you were still there when they turned the document and hadn't run out the door, it could be probably resolved on the spot by law enforcement responding to the DMV office in Gladstone.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. If there were still some question about legitimacy of that, then what would the process be?
The officer would issue a property receipt for the confiscation of the documents that he was going to be taking, and then he would go back through in Milwaukee or in Gladstone. Their document examiner, their fraud person, would look at it and validate whether or not it was you or was not you. If it was not you, you would be charged with a crime.
Right, but I'm a suit follower.
Follow-up.
I'm assuming it is me. I'm saying, okay. I'm a legitimate person, but right. There was some question about this. But it's me, and it's my documents. It's a credible document. And I guess what I'm wondering is, if someone is legitimate, but there's still some question, what the process would be to have my birth certificate returned.
We estimate that the birth certificate and the information you provided as documentation to your identity would be returned to you within 2 days.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I guess when you gentlemen all started off, I was a little confused at what the difference is between what's going on now and what might happen under this bill, what the big difference would be.
Madam Chair, the difference is that DMV currently does not have the authorization to take the documents and to turn them over to law enforcement. Okay. They have to return the document back to the presenter. And what we're asking is that with this bill is that if they suspect that this is a fraudulent document, that they can call police and take custody of that document. And if the police arrive before the person leaves or runs, if the person stays there, it can probably usually be resolved right on the spot. And if they decide that they're going to depart and leave, well, then law enforcement will take it and investigate those documents and take action on if they are in fact fraudulent.
Thank you. So the original House Bill 2899, there really isn't any difference between what's going on now and what that bill said, but it's the amendments that actually make the difference between what's going on in DMV now and what might happen.
Well, even now, Chair Byard, even now, DMV does not have the authority to seize those documents.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Or to take custody of them.
Yeah. Yeah, so the amendment allows that.
Yes.
And then I will say that I distinctly remember, but I cannot remember the bill that was in Transportation Committee last year that we had quite a discussion on seizing documents. So we did have a discussion last year, and it was not quite so simple. and I think because this is an amendment, and maybe people didn't realize, ACLU is not here in the building right now because ACLU had a big problem with a seizing of documents at that point in time, and we're not quite sure exactly what happened over all of this, but do you have any comments on that end of it?
Chair Barr, I believe that we have thought this out. Now, when I say we, I'm also a member of the RISIC, the Regional Economic Crime Investigation Center, and part of this DMV Identity Theft Task Force that the governor has put in place. And we have discussed this at length about the fact that is this fair and is it reasonable? And we believe with the document examination training that DMV clerks office of the people that actually work in the DMV offices receive, that the probability of taking documents that were not in fact false is very small. Once that happens, then within 2 days, we believe we can have this thing turned around, and if they are, in fact, legitimate documents, back to the person who submitted them. So, yes, it's an interference. There's no question about it. But the damage that's done from false documents getting into the system to create false identities has an alarming effect on all the state and individuals and on businesses. The banking industry deals with it daily, and it causes them hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of loss.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Tomei?
Thank you. Chief Counselor, you had mentioned that if somebody goes into, I think you used the word, the Target as a place, if somebody goes into Target and tries to pass a check, have a check written, that the clerk may question. Am I correct in remembering that you said something to that effect, and that the clerk probably then call the manager, would assume, and can the manager keep those documents that were presented to the clerk and the manager?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, yes. And that's exactly what happens. We have this happen all the time in our retail community, where somebody comes in and tries to utter a false check up and use false documents to utter that and represent themselves as that person. Clerks will seize those documents, seize the check, and call the police. Well, as they go to call the police, these people know they're committing a crime, and they usually try to flee. Had they not had a hold of it, that's why you see when you go in and you give your credit card to a clerk in a Fred Meyer store, they take the credit card from you and then they run it through and then they put it into a position outside of your reach. It's so that if it comes back as a fraudulent credit card, they can get a hold of it before you can and run out the door and try it someplace else. And that's exactly why they try to safeguard that.
The other example would be not just on a fraudulent credit card, but be on a stolen credit card. If it was your credit card stolen, somebody is going to use it at Fred Meyer's North here in town, and it's been reported as stolen, the clerk would hold on to it in that matter. So it also would apply like stolen checks, which are falsely uttered, or stolen credit cards.
Follow-up? So I guess I'm just wanting to make it clear that that is legal for the people in a retail establishment to retain those documents. That is legal and legitimate, correct?
Chair, by Representative Tomei, yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
It's been very informative, yes. and very expert witnesses, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your coming.
Before we let Chief Counselor go, Chief Counselor, I haven't been in Milwaukee. As you know, I stay in Salem during the week, and I understand that there was a very serious accident that you just alluded to a little bit. But can you indulge me, Madam Chair,
yes,
to have him talk about that? Thank you.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, yes, and you folks are kind of dealing with the question right now of photo traffic enforcement and a variety of packages. Last week, we had a gentleman who was struck at an intersection, in Milwaukee at Oak Street and Highway 224, at a controlled lighted intersection, and he was killed. And it's one of the highest accident locations within the city of Milwaukee, and I am also proposing that we introduce photo traffic enforcement in Milwaukee. Right now, one of the reasons I'm such a proponent of it is that we don't have any legitimate witnesses to what really took place. And the only other witness to this is dead. The driver of the car, whether he went through a light or didn't go through a light, we can't make an absolute determination because there isn't a witness to it. Well, and if, in fact, had the driver gone through a red light, the camera would have captured that red light violation, and wouldn't do the pedestrian any good, but at least we'd be able to identify who was responsible for the fatality. So it works as a positive also, and if you didn't, if the pedestrian would have violated the red light and run out into traffic, that light, by not taking his picture, that would have identified the fact that the driver did not, in fact, violate a red light and hit the pedestrian. So it works both sides of the spectrum, and it's an excellent tool. We have over 80,000 trips, transit trips through the city of Milwaukee every day on highways 224 and 99, and our accident rate on those two streets represents 50% of all the accidents in the city of Milwaukee. So, they're occurring at primarily eight locations, intersections. It's a horrible problem that technology can help us with rather than hinder.
Thank you for indulging.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2899. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 223.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 223 allows a truck with a fully functional alternate power unit to weigh up to 400 pounds more than the maximum allowable weight for that truck configuration. It would also allow trucks with such power units to exceed the individual axle weight limits. It would take effect upon passage. We have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on this measure coming from the Senate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. And Greg, thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Greg Delpani, ODOT's Administrator for the Motor Carrier Division. You have my written testimony. I'll be brief. Senate Bill 223 attempts to conform Oregon statutes to recently passed federal legislation. It promotes good public policy outcome of reducing engine idling. Very briefly, the Federal Energy Act of 2005 provided for a weight allowance of up to 400 additional pounds for a vehicle configuration if that vehicle is equipped with what is known as an alternative power unit, or APU. The idea here is simple. If you're familiar with the transportation trucking industry, drivers will leave their diesel engines idling all night as they are living in the cab of their truck, the sleeper of their truck. And it powers the heating and air conditioning systems. It provides electricity for electronics, et cetera. The APU is simply most typically a smaller diesel engine, something akin to what you might find in an RV, a recreational vehicle, a generator designed to power that alternative equipment. It reduces the pollutants of the big rig diesel engine idling. It's good for the environment. And this bill provides an incentive to a driver not to lose the weight of the load that he's transporting in order to use this technology. Be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Greg, what is the actual savings of the APU over the truck engine so far as the consumption of the diesel? They're both diesel-operated motors or engines. What are we saving in terms of gallons of fuel per hour, those kinds of things?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that's a question I'm not prepared to answer. I can only observe that the power plant and the diesel rig, by comparison, is vastly larger.
Oh, yes.
And the power plant and the APU is smaller, but I suspect that I have... another expert.
One weighs thousands of pounds, one weighs a few hundred pounds.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell, president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. Representative Butler, there are various kinds of these. We now have some that are strictly battery powered, so that there is no diesel engine. Typically, when there's the small diesel engine, it consumes about 10% of the fuel of the main diesel engine, even while idling. There's a new down in Representative Byers' neck of the woods. There's a Cascade Sierra Solutions that's actually putting these on trucks, and they're loaning the drivers the money to pay for them, and they're actually paying for themselves in less than 18 months. So in terms of reduction in fuel and reduction in fuel costs, the payback is really quick, and then it's long-term after that. So this is a real positive thing.
And if I could follow up, if it's at 90% fuel savings, which is wonderful, I'm pleased to hear it, the battery-powered pack, in terms of weight, is it 400 pounds or less?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the battery technology has really improved in the last year or so, and so, yes, they are under 400 pounds.
And final question, and I'd ask this question of Greg Delpont. If a unit weighs 400 pounds and it takes and it holds an additional 10 gallons of diesel at 10 pounds to the gallon, that's another 100 pounds. You're not giving them the benefit of the fuel that is necessary to operate the APU. You're just giving them the basic weight of the actual instrument. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that's correct. Federal rules were just published. The weight of the fuel is not included, and the allowance is the actual weight of the device not to exceed 400 pounds.
Sounds like to me, Madam Chair, that the battery-powered pack would be the better way to go, and then that way they can put on another load of French fries right on the back, and everybody's off and running.
Any other questions here? I follow up on that one. Does this generator run on a separate tank of fuel, or does it run on the existing tank?
Madam Chair, it runs on the existing tank, generally speaking. It's plumbed right into the existing tanks.
Okay, thank you. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. No other questions? I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 223, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 223.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 223 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilman moves Senate Bill 223 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, those of the opinion, Senate Bill 223 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith, excused. Representative Lemay.
Aye.
Chair Byer.
Aye. Senate Bill 223, having received the required majority, is passed.
Consent calendar.
It has been moved that Senate Bill 223 be moved, put on the consent calendar. Any opposition? Seeing none, so be it. Thank you. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 224.
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 224 repeals the statutory list of qualifications for state-employed railroad inspectors. We have a no fiscal and no revenue impact on this measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with ODOT's Rail Division, and this is the bill that the department required. Actually, it's a very short bill. It repeals a very old statute that's become very outdated that actually interferes with us trying to hire people with the right qualifications. It only recognizes the current statute very limited type of rail experience for the inspector positions. These are very technical positions. Each one has a different discipline that they specialize in because of the complexity of this kind of work. And because it only recognizes limited experience, I actually can't meet what the Federal Railroad Administration would like me to look for when I'm hiring and requires, nor the Department of Administrative Services. So I'm asking you, because both Federal Railroad and DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, exceed what's in statute, so I'm asking to repeal this so that we can recruit for people that are truly qualified for these highly technical positions. They're tied to safety for both the public and railroad employees. It passed unanimously on the Senate floor with everybody that was in attendance that day. There's no opposition that I know of, and I did speak to Delmer Hansen from the United Transportation Union. These are the folks that represent the railroad employees. He asked me to let you know he could not be here today. He supported on the Senate side. He's still supportive of it. The union is, and so with that, I would stop and ask you to support the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, I think everybody's ready to go home. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 224, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 224.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 224 to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? No, seeing none, those of the opinion, Senate Bill 224, should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll vote aye, and those opposed, no, and the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith excused. Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Chair Beyer.
Aye. The motion has carried.
Madam Chair, would you consider moving this to the consent calendar?
It has been moved that this go on the consent calendar. Any opposition? Seeing none, consent calendar.
Fiscal agreement.
All right, and thank you, everybody, for hanging in. Oh, we had a work session down here on House Bill 2422. It has been reposted for Monday. Amendments aren't quite ready, and so it is on Monday. And thank everybody. And remember that we are meeting with the Revenue Committee at 2 o'clock on Monday to hear the cost allocation study. So if you can make it there during that period of time, it would be great. And I understand... Some people have other commitments, but...
And that is in lieu of the 3 o'clock meeting?
No, we're meeting at 3 o'clock. Since we don't meet on Fridays, I think we're going to have to start pushing to get everything in.
Regarding revenue?
Cost allocation. Make sure that trucks and cars are paying their fair share.
And it'll only be about half hour, 1 to 2.
Probably. It shouldn't be too long. So.
I'm just not going to make it because okay. I'll be down.
That's right. Both are waiting.
Are we adjourned?
We are adjourned. Sorry.